Welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, and back pain is a very common problem encountered in primary care settings and community pharmacy practice. Many patients have sciatica, and chronic pain not only impacts quality of life, but also functional capacity. Typically, patients are treated with medications for acute pain, as well as physical therapy. And while non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can be helpful, they aren't always effective. And given that many patients and clinicians want to avoid narcotic analgesics, medications typically prescribed for neuropathic pain, such as tricyclic antidepressants, gabapentin, and pregabalin, are often used. So joining me today to talk about a recently published study are Dr. Austin Morgan, clinical pharmacist with Tria Health in Overland Park, Kansas, and Dr. Frank Feniza, clinical pharmacist and residency site coordinator for Ball's Food Stores in Grandview, Missouri. Frank and Austin wrote a commentary for iFormRx entitled, "Is Newer Really Better? Gabapentin or Pregabalin for Chronic Sciatica?" Austin, Frank, it's great to have you both on the iFormRx podcast today. So welcome.
Thanks, Dr. Haynes.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get started, I'd like to start with a patient case. I want you to imagine you're seeing JT, a 43-year-old Hispanic female who returns to your pharmacy after receiving prescriptions about a month ago for back pain. The patient states she's had chronic back pain for the last 2 to 3 years, but it's become progressively worse. She describes the pain as shooting down her left leg. Previously, the pain was intermittent and sporadic, but it's now persistent and fluctuating throughout the day. Her primary care physician told her that she has sciatica and prescribed ibuprofen 800 milligrams and baclofen 10 milligrams 3 times a day. Although the ibuprofen seems to take the edge off her back pain, the baclofen made her feel really tired, and so she's only been taking it at bedtime. But she's not sure it's doing any good. The patient also has a history of high blood pressure and currently takes lisinopril hydrochlorothiazide 20, 12.5 milligrams daily. Patient says that she's 5'3" tall and weighs 175 pounds, and her blood pressure today is 142 over 86. The patient states that she works as a server at a chain restaurant and doesn't have prescription drug coverage. The back pain has made it difficult to work, but she can't afford to miss work as she's largely dependent on tips for her income. So before we talk about the study published in the journal JAMA Neurology, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that are going through your mind in this case? What additional information would you want to collect and assess during this encounter? And what treatment options, including non-pharmacological options, would you be considering at this point?
The first things that kind of went through our mind are probably primarily this lack of prescription drug coverage that she described and really, you know, the financial aspect of it. We know that medications don't work in patients who don't take them. So if she can't get a hold of the medication because of cost, that's going to be a principal concern. We also want to think about the baclofen sedation side effect that she had. You know, it was severe enough that she isn't maximizing her dose 3 times a day. She's just taking it at bedtime. She is classified as obese with her BMI. So as we're thinking through the med options, we don't want to do anything that could possibly worsen that or cause weight gain, as well as her past medical history of high blood pressure. Some extra questions that we might ask to dig in some of what's going on here. She said that it kind of fluctuates throughout the day, her pain. We'd probably want to find out, is there anything that worsens or improves it? Is it better when she's at work versus when she's at home? Does rest seem to improve it? If she elevates her feet or decreases her activity, does she have improvement there? Does she have any other medical conditions that we're not aware of, any renal concerns? Because some of these common meds that we would consider might need renally adjusted if that's the case. And then we've got some background on the prescriptions that she's tried from her primary care provider, but has she used anything over the counter that has worked or has not worked? what does she rate her pain? And what did she rate her pain before and after starting the ibuprofen, since it seems to take the edge off? How large of an improvement did we see there? And then just kind of from a social history standpoint, some of these medications, especially the anticonvulsants or the gabapentinoids, might be of a concern if there's a history of drug abuse. So if we could get some quick information of, have there ever been any problems or concerns there? Regarding, you know, some of the options that go through our mind, the first one that comes to mind, which ties into the study, would be some of those anticonvulsants. There's really not a ton of evidence, strong evidence, apart from using pregabalin or Lyrica or gabapentin for neuropathic pain. So those would be the two big ones in that category. And then we always have the antidepressants that hit on the norepinephrine as well. So things like duloxetine and venlafaxine, that could be options. If she's having concerns about not being able to work, and if this is impacting her quality of life and mood, that could potentially be, you know, a comorbidity that hasn't been uncovered of some anxiety or depression. So that might be a good option for her if that's the case. But we do need to kind of weigh the risks and benefits with her blood pressure, since there's a chance that especially higher doses of venlafaxine may push up that diastolic blood pressure and worsen that control. We could go down the row of a TCA, and again, got the mood concerns or any insomnia or things like that, it might help, but that could potentially have some more robust side effects and cause problems throughout the day. Opiates, non-preferred. You know, this wouldn't be the first route we would want to go. Tramadol might be of some benefit with lower risk, since it could help with neuropathic pain. If she wanted to try topicals first, there may be some benefit to try an over-the-counter lidocaine or capsaicin, but some questions about the possible effectiveness, as well as maybe some localized side effects there also. So that's kind of quick overview of what we would think about and maybe where we'd start with questioning.
So Frank, let's talk about the study you analyzed for iFormerX, the study which is entitled Effect of Gabapentin versus Pregabalin on Pain Intensity in Adults with Chronic Sciatica, was published online in JAMA Neurology in October 2018, and we provide a link to that paper on the iFormerX website. But for those in our audience who haven't read the paper, can you give us a brief summary of the study design and its major findings?
So this trial was a prospective double-blind randomized crossover study, and I think that's really big to highlight, as not a lot of studies in chronic sciatica with these anticonvulsants in the past have actually been randomized controlled trials. Eligible patients were 18 years or older with unilateral chronic sciatica being treated by a single neurosurgery clinic in Australia. These patients couldn't have prior exposure to gabapentin or pregabalin and were allowed to continue their home medication regimens, including any analgesics they were currently taking. Participants were randomized to one of two treatment sequences involving gabapentin and pregabalin for a total follow-up of 17 weeks. The starting dose of gabapentin was 400 milligrams once a day for 1 week, and that got titrated up to a maximum dose of 800 milligrams 3 times a day. Pregabalin was started at a dose of 150 milligrams once a day for 1 week, and then was titrated up to a maximum dose of 300 milligrams twice a day. Patients were treated with one agent for a total of 8 weeks, then had a 1 week washout period before starting the second drug in the treatment sequence. In the study, the primary outcome was leg pain intensity using the visual analog scale, and the secondary outcome was disability measured by the Oswestry Disability Index. 20 patients were randomized, but only 18 were included in the final analysis. When assessing the outcomes of the study, a statistically significant reduction in leg pain intensity was found for gabapentin as well as pregabalin over the 8-week treatment periods. Interestingly enough, when looking head-to-head, gabapentin was significantly more effective at reducing leg pain intensity than pregabalin. When you looked at the disability based on the Oswestry Disability Index, gabapentin and pregabalin both led to statistically significant mean reductions. I do want to point out, gabapentin was the only treatment to result in both a statistically and clinically significant reduction in both outcomes measured. I think another important piece to look at is adverse drug reactions experienced by patients in the study. Pregabalin was associated with a significantly higher number of adverse drug events compared to gabapentin, and it was about 4 times higher. Nausea, vomiting, and headaches were the most common side effects with pregabalin, while drowsiness and sedation were the most common with gabapentin.
So Frank, let's talk about some of the strengths and weaknesses of this study. This is a pretty small study with only 18 participants, but that's not necessarily a problem if a statistically significant difference in the treatment effect was observed, which in this case, gabapentin was superior to pregabalin in terms of pain reduction using a visual analog scale. What are some of the strengths of this study? And conversely, what are some of the limitations? Are there any threats to the internal validity, such as potential confounders that may have impacted the results?
So when we start to look at strengths, once again, I think the design of the study is key since it was a randomized controlled trial. And when you look at it, we did use two active agents. It wasn't placebo controlled. Based on the half-lives of these drugs as well, a one-week washout period was appropriate in between treatments, so we didn't have to really worry too much about carryover into the sequence. The study did utilize a single center, which can be seen as both a strength and a weakness. I think it is a strength, though, since one neurosurgeon was involved in the screening process, there was consistency in patient recruitment. The outcome measured used in the study were also appropriate, as both the visual analog scale and the Oswestry Disability Index are validated for chronic pain. Furthermore, I think a strength is that thresholds for clinically important differences for the primary and secondary outcomes were established a priori, which helped to highlight that gabapentin was the only treatment to have both that statistically and clinically important reduction in leg pain intensity and disability. And then lastly, one other thing that can be seen as both a strength and a limitation was the ability of these patients to continue their home medication regimens, including analgesics. That does add to the generalizability of the study. As you would imagine, people aren't going to be trying this as their first-line agent. They probably started something earlier on, such as our patient in the case where maybe they were trialing an NSAID or muscle relaxant first, and then we're looking for that add-on agent. When you think about limitations, obviously duration of the study is going to be a problem. Patients were only treated with gabapentin and pregabalin for 8-week durations, with only 4 weeks being on the maximum tolerated doses. Some would say that this is too short of a time period to really get patients to the max effect that the drugs can have. And then we also don't know how these medications would do long-term, so what their durability is going to be for this chronic sciatica. So when we think of the confounders in the study, a big one would be, like we said earlier, patients were allowed to continue their pre-study medication regimens. And so even though the study discussed the medications patients were taking, whether it was acetaminophen with codeine, opiates, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, they didn't talk about doses used. So we're really not sure how much of these medicines patients were on in combination with either gabapentin or the pregabalin, or if those doses were adjusted throughout the study.
All right, Austin. So should the results of this study change practice? Should gabapentin be the preferred first-line agent for chronic pain due to sciatica? And most importantly, back to our patient case, would you recommend gabapentin therapy for her, or would you encourage her to explore other treatment options first with her primary care provider?
Yeah, that's ultimately, I think, the bread and butter question right there, Dr. Haynes, of is this study of 18 patients going to change practice? Overall, there's very little strong data for a preferred treatment with chronic sciatica. This study does give a little bit of teeth to a preferential recommendation for gabapentin, particularly in countries where gabapentin remains much less expensive than pregabalin, like the United States. One thing I think to note about this particular study, we talked about only 18 patients. It was actually designed with a evaluation of outcomes halfway through to make sure that there weren't undue side effects or excessive benefit for one arm versus the other. And they stopped the trial early because they did see a large amount of benefit on one arm. So it's potential that we may have seen an even larger benefit. We don't know. Hopefully this will be something that someone else will duplicate. I think right now for Frank and I, we would recommend gabapentin for our patient, for JT, particularly with the cost benefit analysis here. Lyrica is the pregabalin product available here in the United States, and it's nearly 9 times more expensive for a 30-day max dose than it would be for gabapentin. Obviously, for JT not having any prescription coverage, that's probably not going to be an option at this point in time. gabapentin would be an affordable, relatively safe option to do a trial of. We would want to obviously counsel about sedation. She's working with people in a job that requires a lot of attention. She had problems with sedation before, so we need to make sure that we're not going to impair anything like that. But I think gabapentin would be our first step-up treatment option that we would provide here. If this is going to be a chronic problem that she's dealing with, I think giving her the options of nutritional counseling and some weight loss options to help take pressure off of that nerve and that leg would probably be beneficial. But I think we would probably start with gabapentin. And this study does give us a little bit of evidence that might be a reasonable first-line option.
Well, Austin, Frank, I want to thank you both for joining me today to discuss the treatment of chronic back pain and sciatica, which are very common problems. I think it's clear from your comments, even though this is a small study, it does provide some compelling data that gabapentin may be a preferred option. Certainly, it's a more affordable option. Well, tell us what you think. Remember, only iFormRx members can leave comments and access our growing list of resource pages. Check out our clinical trials and guidelines pages for asthma and for mental health and for substance use disorder. If you are not already a member of iFormRx community, please sign up today. It's free. And be sure to tell all your colleagues, residents, and students to join iFormRx as well. Well, until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, signing off.